So we're going to go ahead and get started, and folks should feel free to eat and drink as you wish. It's great to see so many people here. My name is Todd Presner. I'm the director of UCLA's Allen DVD Center for Career Studies, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to a special book talk, book event today with Sarah Stein, Leah Rosegal, and Annette Hackman. It's couple of notes just to begin. We have an opportunity to engage with a book which was recently published at a Stanford University Press called Lunette of Sin Street. And this book today will be the basis of a conversation that we'll have between our three speakers entitled Colonial Tunisia from the Gutter Up, Lunette of Sin Street, Jews, Translation, and Franco-Tunisian Literature. We're going to do the event a little bit different than we typically do for book events because we're going to have a number of readings from the novella and also interspersed with discussions about the significance and opening up broader questions around translation and the emergence of Franco-Tunisian literature in the early part of the 20th century. And after that, we'll have conversation with the audience, and you also have the chance to purchase the book. It will be available for sale after our event right outside of the room here. I want to mention that we also have the privilege to welcome back Professor Alma Hackman, who is a recent PhD from UCLA in history, and now Assistant Professor of History at UC Santa Cruz, where she also holds the Newfield Levine Chair in Holocaust Studies. And so it's great to have you back and this opportunity for further discussion. I would also want to say that the event today is co-sponsored by the Department of French and Francophone Studies and the Department of History, and made possible by the Levy Center staff, but I also want to acknowledge and thank for all the arrangements they've made. One final note about forthcoming events, and not to take anything away from today's event, but just let you know that Sunday we have a major conference on Primo Levi, and this is part of our Viterbi program in Mediterranean Jewish Studies. It's an all-day symposium, starts at 11 o'clock, goes till evening, and celebrates the English translation of the collected works of Primo Levi. And so it's really a wonderful event coming up. We have programs and brochures in the back, and that'll be Sunday in the Faculty Center if you happen to be free. So briefly, let me introduce our three speakers, starting with the far left, Leah Rosegal, Associate Professor of French and Francophone Studies, a member of Levy Center's Faculty Advisory Board, and she's the author of two books, one of which is Against Autobiography, Albert Namy and the Production of Theory, which came out in 2013 with University of Nebraska Press, and co-editor of Being Contemporary, French Literature, Culture, and Politics Today, Liverpool 2015, and of course, this third book, which she edited and introduced with Sarah Stein, who's sitting in the middle. Sarah Stein is a professor of history, the Risa Motto Endowed Chair in Sephardic Studies, a prolific scholar across the Yiddish and Ladino-speaking diasporas, and author of six books, including most recently Extraterritorial Dreams, European Citizenship, Sephardi Jews, and the Ottoman 20th Century, which came out in 2016 and was the winner of the National Jewish Book Award as well. I also am delighted to say that Sarah will be the director of UCLA Center for Jewish Studies starting on July 1st. And this is one of the first formal introductions, but there'll be a celebration and a changing of the guard, so to speak, celebration in June. But I'm delighted that Sarah will be taking over as director starting July. Finally, Alma Hackman, I mentioned, is Assistant Professor of History and Jewish Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She's a specialist in modern Jewish history of North Africa and the Middle East, with interests in citizenship, communism as a Jewish strategy for political and social emancipation, the politics of belonging, transnationalism, and empire. She's currently working on a book manuscript called Radical Roads Not Taken, Moroccan Jewish Communists 1925-1975, as well as an edited volume dedicated to an international comparative approach to the history of Jewish involvement in radical leftist movements. I just apologize based on myself, which is I have to teach at 1 o'clock and won't even get to participate in the first 45 minutes, but we have a wonderful stewardship by Professor Hackman, and I turn the floor over to my colleagues, Sarah and Leah, who will begin our event.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks.
Thanks, Todd.
So thank you all for, can everybody hear me okay in the back? Thank you all for being here today for this event, which is going to be a slightly different event if you've been to other book talks here at CJS. Sarah and I actually thought that since we're dealing here with a work of literature that's been translated from English from French into English, that one of the most important things we can do in terms of sharing this with you is to let you hear some of this literary work, some of this very interesting style, and allow you to appreciate the work of our translator, who's done such a remarkable job in rendering this text from French into English. So this, we're going to begin with a series of sort of background information and readings from the text before we get into a little bit more sort of nitty-gritty, scholarly and wonky discussion of the context and the text itself. And before we start with a bit of the background, I just wanted to thank the Center for Jewish Studies and the co-sponsors for hosting our event on behalf of myself and obviously on behalf of Sarah as well. And also we'll say a little bit more about these two people later on in the program, but I wanted to mention right away the names of Jane Kuntz and Dina Dihuan. Jane Kuntz is the translator of the text. She couldn't be with us today. But she deserves the great credit for making this very special protagonist speak English. And we'll say a little bit more about her background and her work later on. And Dina Dihuan also will... Dina Dihuan is actually the artist who is responsible for the beautiful cover. If you can't see it from afar, we'll be happy to pass it around. And as Todd mentioned, there'll be copies for sale right outside the door starting around 1:15. So this is very special, original art that we have, directly inspired by Dina's reading of the novella. And she will also, a bit later on in the program, since she's here with us today, unlike the translator, she'll say a few words about her inspiration and her own background. So thanks to everybody, and let me, as I dig into the, did you want to take them? As I dig into the, as we dig into the first reading, I just want to set up what you're about to hear. So Ninette of Sin Street is a novella, so it's a long short story or a shorter novel. It was written in 1938 in French at the height of the French protectorate of Tunisia, a period that lasted from 1881 to 1956. This is a story, as we say, that peers up at colonial society from the gutter rather than down from the balcony of high politics. The book is written in the first person by a female protagonist. Sorry, the book, I should say, is narrated in the first person by a female protagonist, despite the fact that it was written by a teacher at the Alliance Israélite Universelle School in Sfax, which is a provincial town of Tunisia. So before we overload you with any more information about the book, I want to invite you to listen to Ninette's voice herself. So what I'm about to read is from the very, very beginning of the text. Morning, Mr. Director, sir. Well, here I am. It's me, Ninette. Which one, you ask? Well, I guess there are quite a few of us in this town, aren't there? Well, since you asked, I'm the Ninette who lives over that way, as you walk up toward the city walls, and you land right in the middle of the, well, you know, the ladies' quarter. Sin Street, with all due respect. A room in town? Heavens, no, I could never afford that. Not in this life, anyway. Money's what you need for that. And with the chump change I earn working for the rich, 30, 40, all right, let's say 50 centimes in good times, I can just about keep bread on the table for my little boy. So you see, I can't be too choosy. I take what lodgings I can get, a little hole in the wall over by the ladies, who aren't worse than anyone else, mind you, since they do help us through bad times. A small room to clean here, a little laundry there, some errands. I can always earn a few coins off them, too. The trouble is, my little boy here isn't so little anymore, and he's starting to figure things out. You see, all day long we get Senegalese infantrymen, Algerian cavalrymen, Arabs, Bedouins, Maltese, Jews, Greeks, even Sicilians, who come and go, take a look at the merchandise before picking one out to take into a back room and have a go.
So welcome again. And I'm going to pick up from Ninette and from Leah by telling you a little bit more about the historical context for the production of this novella that we describe in some detail in the introduction to this work. So what you have just heard is the voice of the protagonist of the story, Ninette from Sin Street. She writes discreetly about Sin Street, and one learns in the course of the novella that it is a place of sex and sexual violence, including violence Ninette herself is exposed to, a place of parenting and patronage, and also a place of desperation and desire. These are forces that are intermingling on this street in the city of Sfax. But the protagonist of the novella, Ninette herself, as her voice unfolds in the course of this story, is most earnestly invested in the necessities of life, in finding a safe place to sleep, an education for her illegitimate son, and also confronting the challenge of dealing with a sullied past. And in all of this, this novella is really just about ordinary life. And that is why in the opening, Leah said it is a story that allows us to think about colonial society truly from the gutter up. Ordinary life as shaped by complex power relations in a colonial setting amidst a multi-ethnic, multi-religious city marked by class. Now, as Leah mentioned, this novella was first published in French in 1938 in Tunis. It is one of the very first works of Tunisian fiction written in French, and also one of a small number of stories within a corpus of works written by Jews about the local, mostly poor community, Jewish community of Tunisia. Now, our author, Vitalis Danon, who wrote the novella, is himself not from Tunisia. He was a transplant from the Ottoman city of Edirne, but he traveled to North Africa to work for the Alliance Israélite Universelle, an organization that was founded in 1860 by members of the French Jewish elite who were interested in spreading a so-called civilizing project among Jews of the Arab lands, not only in North Africa, but throughout the Middle East, Southeastern Europe, and beyond. So the organization founded its first school in Tunisia in 1878, 3 years before France invaded Tunisia and created, occupied the country and established, which had been under Ottoman rule, established a French protectorate over this territory that had existed for three centuries as a province of the Ottoman Empire. Danon, when he came to Tunisia in 1917, he was scarcely 20, and he arrived, he reached a diverse place. It was a country home to Muslims, to native Jews, to Jews who emanated from elsewhere, especially members of a Jewish mercantile diaspora with roots in Italy and Spain before that. In additionally, many Christians who had come to find work in Tunisia, many of them migrants from Sicily, who over the years of the French protectorate would actually outnumber French women and men under French protectorate rule. Danon's appointment in Tunisia was in the port town of Sfax, a place that has really not received much attention by scholars of North African Jewry before. He served there as a teacher and also as a principal in an Alliance school. It was a poor community. Its members were mostly Arabic speaking. It was, we can say, much less cosmopolitan than the home he knew in the Ottoman Empire, Edirne, and also certainly less cosmopolitan. Did I say less cosmopolitan than Edirne? I meant to say a less cosmopolitan center than his home of Edirne, but also less cosmopolitan than Tunis to the north or nearby Sousse. Danon would call Tunisia his home for half a century, and this is an unusually long time for an Alliance teacher to remain in one place. And he married a local Tunisian Jewish woman. He raised children in Tunisia and those children called Tunisia their main home. He himself didn't stay in the port of Sfax his entire life. The family relocated to Tunis, and it was there that he met Jacques Vial and Rivel, Tunisian Jews who also worked for the Alliance as instructors and who were engaged in developing chronicles, in narrating the story of the Jewish neighborhood of Tunis, known as the Hara. And the three writers bound together, developing a shared literary project, earning them the moniker the Tunis School. And individually and together, through their co-authored and individual projects, these three writers became the founding fathers of modern Judeo-Tunisian literature, and also the founding fathers of Francophone Tunisian literature more generally. This so-called Tunis School of writers gravitated towards themes of Jewish life in Tunisia, especially as it was shaped in this neighborhood, the Hara, in which Jews were concentrated. They called it imprecisely the ghetto. It wasn't a ghetto in the medieval European sense of the word. It was the Hara, a permeable space, a multicultural quarter where people of different religions and origins met, conducted commerce, and socialized and lived. And it was home as well to most of their pupils, the AIU students and their families. And it is here, in the heart of the Hara of Tunis or of Sfax, that Danon would have encountered women like the fictionalized Ninette. And with that, we would like to transition to a second passage of Ninette of Sin Street.
So I'm going to pick up where I left off. As you just heard, Ninette opens with the arrival of the titular protagonist to the AIU school or the Alliance school of Sfax. Ninette is there not for herself, ostensibly, but for her illegitimate son, Israel, whose destiny she is hoping to change and shape through education. And so as we've heard, she's very concerned about the fact that her son is growing up in the ladies' quarter and he's starting to understand what kind of business gets done there. So, Ninette says, as she narrates her story to the school director, "Everyone said, take your son to the Jewish school. So here I am. You'll take him, of course, won't you? They wouldn't have him anywhere else since he doesn't have the papers, you see. You know, birth certificates, that sort of thing. Where do you think I can get them? The kid's got no father. I was dumped as soon as I confessed that there was a little one on the way. No offense meant, sir, but that's the honest truth. No sense hiding it. Everybody knows. So you understand the tricky situation I'm in at present. But I do know he's mine. Isn't that right, my little Israel? Look at him, will you? All nice and clean. So you'll take him, right? You can't go turn me out like the others have, can you? You'll sign him up, right? What's that bit of paper everyone's asking for anyway? Something that important, wouldn't the Creator have tacked it on when he made us? My son's name, you ask? I just said it, didn't I? Israel. Israel what? How am I supposed to know? You're cleverer than me. What do you call a kid who's missing a father? As for me, I'm Ninette, the one and only. You haven't heard of me? Really? Well, how can that be? Maybe it's because you're not from these parts. Or you look the other way when your nasty little charges are pelting me with stones when school lets out. You've never seen the way they corner me, then grope and pinch me until I'm black and blue? Just for laughs, they say. Just for jollies. Come on, I know what men are all about. Pigs, the lot of them, save one or two. They get all excited seeing me on my back like that, arms and legs flailing. Very sorry, sir. I don't mean to annoy you. Oh, come on, do a girl a favor and take my son in. Don't go and send him away for something so silly. Sign him up and teach him how to put ink on paper. Make a man of him. He doesn't have to be a genius, I'm not that ambitious, but a man who'll get me out of this mess I'm in. Look at me. I'm only 26, but I've been working for the last 15 of those years, doing this and that, and underpaid, scolded, and beaten, oh yes, kicked in the behind, and fed in the kitchen where the lady of the house has me eat along with the cats. Who wouldn't be this spiteful and hateful when year in and year out, day and night, you're doing nothing but washing, scrubbing, rinsing, polishing, ironing, mending, cooking special little dishes for Madame, she's got a delicate stomach, poor thing, and for Monsieur, who stuffs himself. All right, I'll hold my tongue. That's what happens when I get angry. They're right to slap me around. They have to beat some sense into me now, don't they? I'm like fresh octopus. The harder you hit them, the tenderer they get. So it's done then. You'll sign him up, my son. And I'll be off. Happier than when I came, that's for sure. And I'll be thinking to myself on the way, Ninette, old girl, you're a fool. Always been one, in fact, that much is clear. But that doesn't mean your son has to be one. You'll wear yourself out for years to put your son through school, to dress and feed him. And if that means taking hard-earned bread out of your own mouth, then so be it. You'll be doing it for him. And you'll show the world that Ninette can do things right when she sets her mind to it. Ah, my son. When he's all grown up and earning a living, there won't be a mother on earth prouder than me. We'll stroll arm in arm around the bandstand when the fine ladies strut by in their feathered hats with their la-di-da airs, with their busts and bustles all rustling in silk. And my son will pat me on the hand and say, don't worry, Mama, I'm rich. Let's go to the shops and buy whatever we want. So off we'll go window shopping and pick out a few things, though he says there's nothing that's good enough for me, dear boy. And fine linens, gowns, and draperies, we'll buy them all by the dozen, even by the bolt. And jewelry for me, pearls and diamonds. And 1,000 francs, and then another 1,000 he puts in my purse saying, here, Mama, take this and give it to the poor. And when it's all gone, there'll be more, don't forget. That's what my son's going to be. That's what he'll be saying someday. Oh, but don't look at me now with my torn skirt, my faded scarf, my bare feet and secondhand slippers from the Roba Vecchia. Money's round. It rolls. One day to you, another day to me, and on it goes. What makes you think it wouldn't make a stop by my door one day and brighten up my life a little bit? Don't you think old Ninette has earned herself a little attention from the Almighty? Hasn't she? Never hurt anyone in my life, have I? Not even a fly. Folks will tell you as much. Always wanted good, never evil. It's just that the good wanted nothing to do with me, so it was evil that came along instead. So there he is, sir. I'm putting him in your hands, my little one. He's the apple of my eye, he is. He's not a bad boy, you'll see. He's just too scared, that's all. He's been beaten about so much by me and everyone else that he raises an elbow for cover as soon as anyone comes close. And he shakes. Good Lord, how he shakes. After giving him a good walloping, I'm always on my knees begging for forgiveness, hugging him, kissing him, and crying my eyes out. I roll on the ground like a kitten to let him stomp all over me. That's my boy, my little man, the love of my heart. But he's the enemy, too, living proof of my shame and the wickedness of some man. You've got the patience of Job to hear me out like this. Send me away. Come on, send me away already. We'll be here all night otherwise, all year even, until the end of the world. I'm a chatterbox. Don't mind me. Once I open my mouth, there's no shutting me up. So good day to you, sir. I'm back to my pots and pans now. Have to keep a living whether your heart's full of cares and woe or singing like a bird. Get a move on, Ninette. Keep on going till you get to the other side, where there's no more shame or grief, no more birth certificates or bastards or anything. We're all the same, my lovely ladies, all a feast for worms, with a clump of earth for a pillow and a nice-sized stone on the belly. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's just like I say, like what the rabbi reads at the synagogue. You haven't heard him? You might go have a listen someday. Oh my, what you'll learn about what's waiting for you out there. It'll make you think twice before messing around, since we're all going to end up keef-keef, big and small, nasty and kind-hearted, the do-nothings and the have-nothings, even the fellow tooling around in his automobile. That's a consolation, old girl, and not the least. So see you next time, sir, alive and well. If it's all right with you, Ninette will be stopping by from time to time after class to see how the little one is doing. And especially, if you please, sir, don't ask me any questions, all right? There have been such unspeakable things in my life. I don't really care so much. I'm just plain old me. I don't hold anything back. But you, sir, I wonder how much you can stand to listen to an unwed mother who lives on Sin Street. So this is the end of chapter one. And at the end of chapter one, we see that Ninette has successfully convinced the director to enroll her son, Israel, in school. And for the next years, she'll return to the director's office over and over again, each time, in each chapter, delivering a kind of new installment of the backstory of her life. Ostensibly, she's there to check on her son's progress, but it turns into a sort of form of talk therapy for Ninette. She, again, speaks in a monologue. We rarely, if ever, hear the director intervene in her story. And it's through these series of monologues that we're able to reconstitute Ninette's story from when she was a little girl through stories of, as Sarah mentioned, the death of her parents, an episode of sexual violence that forces her to leave her hometown in shame, and then a kind of peripatetic journey that takes her from Sfax to Tunis and back, and that eventually ends up with her becoming pregnant with the son of a noble, with the son of a man who belongs to a much higher caste than she does and for whom she had been working as a domestic servant. And so Ninette gives birth to Israel and then goes through both the pain and joy of discovering what it means to be a mother in this particular situation, in the very precarious position in which she finds herself. So as you already will have been able to make out, our Ninette speaks in a very colorful local patois, complete with borrowings, colloquial borrowings from Jewish scripture, idiomatic grammar, some words and expressions that come from both Italian and Arabic. You might have picked out the word roba vecchia, which is Italian for old clothes. You might have also picked out the word kif kif, which is Arabic, which means it's all the same. Again, her story takes this kind of stream of consciousness form, punctuated by these chapters and these visits. Confessional talk therapy that's plucky, funny, clever, notwithstanding the very serious and sometimes upsetting story it tells. As we mentioned, Ninette survives rape and rejection, poverty and hopelessness, and somehow pinches together a fragile existence in the face of this tragedy. In the penultimate chapter, Ninette shows up at the director's office to share some news and to tell him the next installment of her life story, which is the tale of Israel's birth. So by this point in the story, the director already knows that Ninette has a bad past and that she has been in a bad place. And it's very interesting to note how Ninette always uses euphemisms to talk about the terrible things that have happened to her and the terrible places in which she's lived. So already in the first chapter, you've heard she refers to the ladies' quarter. She refers to being in a bad place, and she's constantly apologizing to the director for being vulgar, even though in fact she's using euphemisms to cover what would be ultimately very, very hard stories to listen to. So despite all she's been to, thanks to a local rabbi, she's found a respectable job as a maid, working for a widow and her adult son, and these people are wealthy, respected pillars of the Jewish community. They are, as Ninette says over and over again, good people, quote-unquote good people. And all goes well for a time until Ninette begins a romantic relationship with the son, as I mentioned, and winds up pregnant. The family then kicks her out summarily and leaves her to find solace with a woman named Rachela, who is, we might say, a kind of innkeeper with a heart of gold, known for taking in the wretched of the earth. And so now we're going to listen to a segment when, as Ninette sets up this episode of her life story. You'll hear her start in the present tense and then recount Israel's birth in tough circumstances. You'll hear her talk about how she first rejected her son, but then quickly came to love him.
Mr. Director, sir, this time you're going to rejoice along with me. For once, I'm bringing you some good news. Seems a new Kaid, a local official, has just been appointed to our good city. Oh no, he's no ignoramus. He studied French and all to become a lawyer. How about that? You know how lawyers are, all such good talkers. It's their job. No one holds it against them that they can turn black into white and make an assassin innocent right there in the hands of the police. The Kaid says he's going to find a way to get a birth certificate for my son. Even without a known father, you got it. Even without a known father. I told you lawyers could do anything, didn't I? And how is it that Ninette has connections in high places now, huh? She goes to chat with the Kaid just as if he were Zegnini the grocer or Tektuk the baker. So let me tell you the story behind it all. Mr. Joseph, the sheikh for us native Jews here, he met up with me recently and he said, so is it true, Ninette, that you have a kid that's not registered? How come? And I told him the short version of the story of my life, since he wasn't yet sheikh when all the stuff I told you was happening to me. Mr. Joseph, moved by my plight, says, well, I'll be. That's some story you've got there. You can count on me, Ninette. The Kaid is a man of law who knows how things work. Rest assured, we'll do what it takes. too bad for me that Mr. Joseph wasn't Sheikh back when all this was happening. Things would have turned out very differently. And what would have become of me without Rachella? I would have had my baby in some alley like a dog. And she had too much else to do to be running in the Kaid's office to explain what all was going on with me. So let me pick up where I left off. You remember that I beat the mother and spit at the son. You can only imagine that after all that, I didn't have an ounce of strength left. But I grabbed my bundle, and with the other little bundle I was carrying inside me, I reached Rachella's house dead tired. That good woman took my things and gave me her arm to help me up the stairs. Oh, you poor child, what in the world have you done now? That was the only word of reproach I ever heard from her. She took me to a little room with a bed and said, "This will be your room until you deliver. We'll see what happens after that." Troubled, sick, disgusted with everything, I didn't do much around the hotel, but Rachella left me free to do what I wanted. There were days when I didn't even get out of bed, exhausted after a sleepless night. It became a habit of mine to lay wide awake, staring at the ceiling. And the gloomy days went on, and the sleepless nights piled up. And then my memory went blank. Later on, Rachella told me how it all happened. Early one morning, around dawn, she heard mewing sounds, followed by groans, then a moment of silence, then cries, mewing, and groans started up again. Several times, she sat up in bed, thinking she was having a nightmare of some sort. Drowsy and a little fearful, she stayed in bed instead of going to find out where the sound was coming from. But when the mewing noises became insistent, she figured it out and headed straight for my room. She found me lying on my back, and between my blood-stained thighs was a little wailing being. "Ninette, have you lost your mind? Are you trying to do yourself in or what? Why didn't you call for me? Having a baby all by yourself, that's just craziness. Well, let's see what you've had, at least. A boy. Be glad. You've just given birth to the person who will save you someday. We'll love that little thing together, won't we now?" Rachella woke up everyone in the hotel, sent for a midwife, changed my sheets, and gave me my baby to hold. That little, reddish, puckered-up thing, my future savior, you've got to be kidding. He's ugly as sin. The next day, and the following days, until the 8th, the whole city's worth of curious gossipers dropped by to congratulate me, not without a hint of sarcasm. Face against the wall, all I could do was cry. If I had been able to speak and answer back to each and every one with a little tidbit I happened to know about their own personal history, not always a pretty picture, that would have set the cat among the pigeons, wouldn't it have? On the 8th day, the day of circumcision, some real drama took place in the hotel courtyard. The father is supposed to be the one who holds the baby while the knife wielder cuts the bit of skin. But where was the father? Doesn't matter. We'll find some man of goodwill. But what should the baby be named? Ask Ninette. But Ninette is still in her deaf-mute state. No, she doesn't want this child. We should just turn it over to the auctioneer to sell or give it away to a childless couple. Finally, they came to an agreement as to what to name the baby. Look, since he's a little Jew, we'll call him Yisrael. A little while later, I held my baby up in front of me, and then, as if I was dealing with a responsible person capable of understanding me, I said to him, "So, it's just the two of us now, little stranger's seed. You wanted to come into this world, did you? Well, here you are. And a good job you did of it too, son of mine. You have come, no doubt about that, but let me tell you, it's no fun. Life is beautiful for the tough ones, the clever ones, those who know how to get around. There aren't many of those, you know. They're the ones in charge, who order everyone else around. And the rest of us, there are thousands who are fighting over a job or a crust of bread. The dumbest, the fools, the flock of sheep. They get led around however and wherever the top dogs say. And what about you now? Which side will you be on? What are you doing here? Since there's no place for either of us in this world, what name am I going to use to introduce you? Me and you will be held at arm's length, like something contagious. You shouldn't have done it, son of mine. It's not good what you've gone and done. You should have left me alone to wander down this damn road I'm on. Maybe I might actually have gotten somewhere in the end. But there are the two of us now, and with your appetite for life, you'll take everything I've got, my days, my nights, my time off, my wages." I went on letting off steam like that for some time. Then I noticed that the little one had calmed down, almost as if he understood what I'd said. He looked at me with those big eyes for just a second, and then he turned his head and looked to the light that was streaming in through the window. It was a bright winter sun that was rising. I shuddered with cold at the sight of the damp walls across the way and the steamed-up windows. I started up again, this time talking more to myself than to him. "Son, don't get too comfortable now. For a moment, we've sheltered from the worst, but what's to become of us tomorrow? Where are we going to lay down our load? Tell me that, little pumpkin. Looking a little tired you are. Something hurting you somewhere? And you're hungry and thirsty, too, I'll bet. Tough luck for you that were born of me, Nanette. When you walk down the street, folks will point and laugh, and you'll be cursing your mother's womb and the hour when you were conceived. You see, a woman's folly means a lifetime of suffering. And suffer you will, my little one. And here I am already mistreating you myself, as if it were me that were your enemy. Is God punishing me twice over? After giving me a son with no father, he's hardening my heart too. Come over here. Let me have a look at you. So I don't want to give away the end completely, but I want to let you know that the sun will actually come to shine on a little bit more brightly on these poor rejects, and I want to read very, very briefly our last reading from Ninette's final visit to the Allianz school director. Thank you. So it's time to say farewell, and that's all I've come by today, Mr. Director, sir. We're leaving your school. Well, not me, my son, I guess. But me too. I've known you for 6 years now, and I guess I consider myself one of your pupils, in a way. Oh, not the smartest of them, that's for certain. The dumbest, I'd say. The last in the class. But I'd say I've earned an A+ for effort and the will to do well. My son is leaving for vocational school now. Thanks to you, once again, he was admitted even without all the right papers. The rabbi often says that that which has been bent cannot be made straight again. I don't believe that one bit. Just this once, though, I think he may be right. You see, neither the Kaid nor the Sheikh nor you were able to find a way of getting my son registered on the books. Let's face it, you can't create a father out of thin air for a child who's almost 12 years old. For all that, Mr. Director, sir, I thank you. And now it's my turn to give you a piece of news. You know what I've been striving for all these years? To go live on the avenue lined with palm trees facing the bandstand? Well, the other day I was just walking along, head down, mulling a million little things in my head, and suddenly the director of the African Bank stops me in mid-step with these words.
Well, hello there, Ninette.
Good day to you, sir, I answered back politely.
Is it true, Ninette, that you've been left with a child who isn't yet old enough to work, but who's learning a good trade at school?
That's right.
And how are you managing in the meantime?
How am I managing? God only knows. I wash, I rinse, I mend, I iron, I do household chores.
And where is it you're living?
Sin Street, sir.
That's not good. Not good at all. Because of your son, you understand. The gentleman stopped and thought a moment and then said, Listen, Ninette, if it's really true that you're on the straight and narrow for good, as I've heard tell, I'm going to set you up as a concierge at my bank, with a place to live and such a monthly salary. You'll live there with that boy of yours. How does that all sound to you?
How does it sound? You're asking me how all that sounds? If I weren't worried you'd take it wrong, I'd give you a big kiss.
You can have a day off for your son's bar mitzvah, Ninette, and my wife will be a witness. Go now and pack up your house and get moved in.
And that's where things stand now, sir. Well, those are the readings, and that is the context that we prepared for you, and we are turning now to a kind of second and third act of today's event. Before we turn the table over to Alma Heckman, who will be carrying on a kind of discussion with us before we open up the floor, we wanted to offer the microphone for a couple of moments to Dina Diwan, who, as Leah mentioned, created original art for the cover of this book. Dina was born in Lebanon, in Beirut, and left for Italy in 1975 when the Civil War broke out, joining her family in Paris. Trained as an architect, she created her own studio in Paris and there for 20 years practiced as an architect and an artist. and has included residential and art commissions in France and Tunisia. Her wonderful art deploys overt references to architectural elements such as city grids, gardens, and maps. It has been displayed in Paris, in Los Angeles, and soon, if I'm not mistaken, in Beirut. She lives and works in Los Angeles and very kindly has joined us to offer a few words of her own.
First, I want to thank Sarah and Lia who introduced me to this text and who offered me to illustrate its cover. My immersion in the universe of Ninette truly touched me, as it shows a world where different cultures came together: Arab, French, Italian, Maltese, Jewish, and many others. I'm from the Mediterranean region, which has remained under my skin since my departure from Beirut. And this was in 1975 when I was 13. And then it was in France that I first discovered all the nuances of Jewish culture, Sephardic and Ashkenazi. And it was also in France that I discovered other Jews and other ways of being Jewish. The ones from Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, Rhodes, and the one from Warsaw, Vienna, Berlin, and from all of Europe and Asia. I married a Nigerian Jew, and we were unable to visit neither Algeria nor Lebanon during the years of conflict. So for almost 15 years, we traveled in Tunisia with our children to prolong the moment when Jews and Arabs danced to the same rhythms and shared all the aspects of everyday lives. And so that this light can continue to shine, we must commit to building these bridges, literary, poetic, artistic, and all sorts of cultural exchanges, just like Vitaly Stanon, who offers us this possibility, which Lia and Sarah have rendered so well. And thank you again. Thank you for having brought Ninette across the oceans towards new horizons. Now she may also be in America.
Thank you. So I have a million questions, and I'm very excited to be in this role because I get to dominate that for a little while by asking tons of questions. Oh, sorry, now can you hear me? And I just came up with another one while you were talking too, but maybe I'll come back to that one later. But the first thing I want to know is, what is the origin story of this project? How did you first come across this text of Ninette of Sin Street? And what was the process of deciding to publish it in this way? And along with that, the sort of linguistic choices that you made with the translator. I know you mentioned in the introduction to the volume that you had a lot of choices for how to render this kind of patois language that Ninette spoke on the street, which is a very unique kind of combination. I haven't read the original French text, but I'm imagining it was French plus Italian plus Arabic plus Hebrew plus all these things, and how to translate all of those dynamics into English. And you mentioned the antebellum South as one potential, or even some American English settler colonies. So if you could expand both on origins and presentation.
I'll get started, and then I'll let Sarah fill in whatever gaps I create in the story. This was published just last year. I think the publication date is 2017 on the translation. It's a project Sarah and I have been working on for a very long time. The discovery of the text itself, it should be said that even in French, this particular novella, which is called in French, and I have the version here if anybody wants to take a look at it afterwards, Ninette de la Rue du Péché. The work itself is not very well known in France or the French-speaking world, nor is Vitalis Danon, the author, anything close to a household name. Indeed, the Tunis School, so this would be Danon and the two other writers that he collaborated with, are simply not studied. I would say they've almost been consigned to sort of the dustbins of literary history. Part of the reason for this partly has to do with accessibility of the texts. A lot of them have been allowed to go out of print. Ninette de la Rue du Péché, interestingly, was recuperated and reprinted, I believe, in the early 2000s, thanks to a collaboration between the Alliance Israélite Universelle and an editor in Paris called Le Manuscrit. And so it is one of the few, if not the only, remaining text of the Tunis School that is in circulation in a kind of contemporary way. And when I say contemporary way, what's nice about this is you can buy a PDF of the novella in French online if you like. So basically these authors and their texts are very, very little known even in the French-speaking world. And my discovery of Danon and the Tunis School dates back to a period when I was working on my dissertation on another Judeo-Tunisian writer, Albert Memmi, probably the best known, probably one of the best known Tunisian writers, period. Certainly one of the best known Francophone North African writers. You may be familiar with his novel, The Pillar of Salt. You may perhaps be more familiar with his very famous anti-colonial treatise, The Colonizer and the Colonized. And while I was working on a dissertation on the work of Albert Memmi, it was sort of incumbent upon me to kind of dive into the world that he would have been a part of and to try and figure out what his sort of literary genealogy might be, what his sort of literary family tree might look like. At the time, I had no idea if he had precursors in French in Tunisia. And it turned out he did. And so it was through my desire to sort of deepen my own knowledge of the cultural matrix that produced an Albert Memmi that through obsessive Googling and somewhat slightly more sophisticated library research, but not that much more sophisticated, to be honest with you, I stumbled across the Tunis School and their works. Sarah and I met in 2008 when we both started at UCLA, and we had this kind of instant sort of camaraderie, if I may say, and confluence of intellectual interests. And Sarah proposed that we work on a project together. And at the time, the Center for Jewish Studies was very generously offering a grant for faculty collaboration called the Ross Collaborative Grant. And so I mentioned this text and how much I wanted to use it in the classroom, but how disappointing it was that I could only share it in French, in French language situations, which in and of itself is not disappointing. It's just that it doesn't allow us to reach a large number of students, and how I really wish that this work, at least, if not all the works by the Tunis School, were available in English so that we could, in the context of Jewish studies classes, which are almost always given in English, reach a kind of broader constituency and introduce a broader range of students to these texts and also to the existence of this Jewish literature from Tunisia, which is not, again, not very well known even within Jewish studies circles and throughout the American Academy. So we had this idea to use this collaborative grant to have the novella translated. It's about 100 pages of text. It was too big a job for either one of us to take on at that point in our careers, the actual translation work. And so through various circumstances, we found Jane Kuntz. Jane Kuntz is Ninette's perfect translator. Jane has a PhD in French literature, but perhaps more importantly, she lived in Tunisia for 20 years. She moved to Tunisia in 1975 as a member of the Peace Corps, and she lived in a smaller town on the Algerian border called El Kef. She eventually married the son of El Kef's sort of chieftain, and so Jane was deeply, deeply immersed in Tunisian culture, and El Kef was also a crossroads of Christian, Muslim, and Jewish culture. And so she was deeply immersed in a city that had a long history of multiculturalism and sort of pan-religious identity. Jane has also, I'll say a few more words about her now. She's also translated the work of another very famous Tunisian writer, Abdelwahed Medeb. She translated his experimental novel, which is called Talismano, both in French and in English. And she more recently translated a text, not a Tunisian one, but Ivan Yablanka's The Grandparents I Never Had. Is that the correct title?
History of the Grandparents I Never Knew.
History of the Grandparents I Never Knew. Also translated, published in translation by Stanford. So Jane, and incidentally, she's also translated some of Dina's artist statements and biographies. So Jane, it was really the ideal conduit for Ninette's voice in English, because of her intense and deep contact with Tunisian culture, both Francophone and Arabophone. So that's the origin of how we found this. I'm sorry if it's a bit long. As it turned out, Sarah and I had numerous challenges getting this text published. Even though Vitalis Danon passed away in the mid-60s when he was living in Nice, the novella didn't fall into public domain. Or it was not considered to be in publishable without obtaining rights from a living relative. So Sarah and I spent many years, and probably more time on Facebook than we'd like to admit, trying to hunt down living relatives of Vitalis Danon. There are many Danons out there. None of the ones we talked to were the descendants of Vitalis, although at one point, this is a crazy story, I found a man who I believed to be his grandson, who would have been working at who'd become a doctor, who trained to be a doctor in Israel, and who had immigrated to the United States, and as far as I could tell, was working at a hospital in Chicago. And I called their records department, and they told me that, I can't remember his first name now, but that Dr. Danon had retired and moved to Ireland, like 2 months before I called, so it was extremely frustrating. And they couldn't give out any of his personal information, but they would be happy to transmit a message. And the lady who was working in the records room was really kind of curious about the story of why I wanted to contact him, and I think she kind of wanted to play a role, and so she reached out to him, and then she wrote back to me, and several times we went back and forth, but unfortunately we never got an answer from this mysterious Dr. Danon somewhere in Ireland. Luckily, several years later, through Sarah's contact with Stanford University Press, and really Kate Walsh's, the now editor-in-chief, Kate Wall, who's now editor-in-chief at Stanford, through her interest in the project, we were able to find some lawyers who gave this book a wonderful status. They called it an orphan manuscript. And through
just like Ninette says, lawyers can turn black into white.
Exactly. So through the orphaning of Ninette, actually, we were able to gain the right to publish it. And so we're also very, very grateful to the Alliance Israélite Universelle and our contacts there, who helped us facilitate some of the paperwork for other bits of Danon's papers that are published in an appendix in this book. But that's the long origin story. Let me just say a few quick words about translation. Do you want to fill in anything? Let me just say a few quick words about translation. Obviously, for us to talk about the translation, we're speaking as the editors and not the original creators of the translation. But Sarah and I went back and forth quite a bit with Jane on some of the, what I would call stylistic and aesthetic decisions. Alma mentioned in her question something that we reference in the introduction, which is, how do you render a very sort of specific local vernacular, a prose that is sort of folklorish and sometimes a bit, might come off a bit corny, how do you render it into English without a reference point? And if you pick a reference point, what does that do to overdetermine the way the text is received, right? So one way that the first draft of the English read, at least to my ears, was a little bit too rooted in the American South and a little bit too, I would use the expression, I don't know how common this is, but a little bit too sort of cornpone. Some of the things Ninette said were taking us too far from Tunisia and putting us too specifically into another place. There's an expression in French that was something like, it was actually a rather simple expression in French that we could have translated as all day long. And Jane, in her sort of absolutely admirable desire to allow the English to sort of sparkle and reveal its local color where it made sense, translated that as all the livelong day. And although we certainly got where she was going with that, there were moments, this is just one example, I won't give you too many, but there were moments like that where we felt that this was overdetermining the way the English appeared, and it made it seem too rooted in a context that would be divorced from its specificity. And so we tried to go through, and really we combed through very intensely to try to make sure that we got expressions that weren't too dated, that weren't too easily indexed to a certain context or history that would take us out of the spirit of Ninette. And when I heard Sarah's reading and she mentions Israel as her little pumpkin, mm-hmm. is a moment where I think to myself, I wonder if we should have left in the pumpkin or not. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I think once you get into the flow of Ninette, it feels very organically one voice of a kind of exotic other world. And that's really, I think, the best we could hope for in this work.
Yeah, I mean, did you want to add?
No, go ahead.
I wonder about the octopus too, but maybe that's because that's a moment. I mean, that's maybe a tangential question. Mm-hmm. But if the octopus was a moment of close translation, if the
Absolutely.
Octopus
that
had something to do with a local Tunisian context, yeah. that we wouldn't. I don't know. Maybe you all think about macerating octopi. I don't particularly.
Yeah, that one was basically word for word.
Well, kind of related to that, and you mentioned the translator's initial desire to use a southern accent, mm-hmm. maybe in some ways to communicate something about Ninette's social mm-hmm. class.
Absolutely.
Maybe mm-hmm. something to communicate how non-elite she is mm-hmm. and what she mm-hmm. appears to be mm-hmm. among a dominant cultural linguistic landscape. And this ties into my next question, which is that usually studies of the Alliance Israélite Universelle, or what I'm very familiar with, is thinking about a big divorce occurring between Muslims and Jews, mm-hmm. The sort of widespread acculturation between Jews learning French language, being immersed in French culture, as a divorcing mechanism from Muslims. But something that's so unique about Ninette is Muslims come up basically not at all, mm-hmm. except for in the appendix, really, mm-hmm. not in the main text mm-hmm. of Ninette itself, but rather these huge class-based gulfs within mm-hmm. the Jewish community mm-hmm. itself. And I wonder to what extent Ninette is sort of a liminal character, that she's mm-hmm. not so much there to represent Jewishness or the Jewish Alliance project, but that she's there as a sort of subversive Tunisian character mm-hmm. above all, that she's something representing Tunisian lower classes more than she is about Jewish regeneration. And there's mm-hmm. an interesting interplay that Ninette is very subversive in many ways that you highlight in the introduction, especially about religion, mm-hmm. But also about her position among other Jews and even the regeneration project. And I don't want to overlord, you got to hear some great readings, but there are some wonderful quotes, and there's one that really encapsulates this. She says, "Sometimes I say to myself, Ninette, I say, if I were the Almighty, just supposing, right, or something like that, I would send some huge disaster to the world, and then we'd start all over. But it seems, according to the rabbi, that he already tried that once, and it didn't work out so well. A shame, isn't it? So now, to keep us waiting, they're promising us a Messiah." And then she goes on to talk about how Tunisians are poor Tunisians. She doesn't specify Jews, but it's understood in her area. She says, "Nobody wants to defend us since we're just nobodies from nowhere. No one gives a damn. We've been living like this for years now, and they'll let us go on living in the same filth. And if you kick up a fuss about it, they'll be hell to pay. They'll call you an anarchist, a communist, or who knows what else. And you'll end up in the slammer because you supposedly want to set the town on fire." And then there's one more to counterpose this. This is when she's working for these damnable fancy employers whose son puts her in this terrible way. And she has some really choice words about this guy, by the way. She calls him a mollusk, which mm-hmm. I really enjoyed. She's like, "How did I sleep with this mollusk? I can't believe it." there's one more quote. This is when she first meets this mother. "It was the mother who opened the door, a Jewess, like other Jewesses I've known, plump, chubby-cheeked, pot-bellied, but with a stern air about her, the high and mighty type that shuts your trap just looking at her. Old? Not exactly, but well past 40, if you get my meaning. She gave me the once-over so brash that I almost opened my mouth to let her look inside while she was at it. Have a look at my teeth, ma'am, all present and still in good shape, which to an American reader summons images of the slave market very instantaneously. So it's an interesting, connected to that translation, class, oppression, what does this have to do with Jewishness? So if you could comment on those intermixing elements.
Should I give it a go?
Yeah.
Well, I would say that, you know, if we think about the Jewish world at the time at which Danon first went to Tunisia, he's a young man, really the leitmotif of Jewish history at that time, this is the second decade of the 20th century, is poverty. And also the leitmotif of global Jewish history is a stark difference between the haves and the have-nots. So if Danon had gone, had been trained as an Alliance teacher in Paris, which he was, but he had been placed in Bulgaria, let's say, as a teacher, he could have written the same story, I think, about the haves and the have-nots in Shumla, Bulgaria, or some such, you know, some or Romania, or in Turkish Anatolia, or fill in the blank. And in the world of Yiddish letters, of course, you're also finding the same kind of ethnographic fiction in which writers are inventing poor protagonists to depict the tremendous injustices and class disparities within the Jewish world. So I think on some level, it's actually, if she's liminal, in my reading, it's not Tunisia that her liminality represents, but rather Jewish poverty, and maybe especially what it means to be a woman, you know, and an unmarried woman, and an unmarried woman who has, by force, has been obliged to dabble in prostitution, and an unmarried woman who has a son without a father. I see that as, in a way, what she represents in the text and for Danon, but I'm a historian, so I think I'm situating her in that rather more, you know, broad social context. But I think it's no coincidence also that so many of these writers who wrote as what I might call ethnographic fiction, you know, Leah folkloric writing would have other words for it probably, but many of them also were either socialist or communist allied. And so there is a politic of celebrating and elevating the Jewish poor that I see in Danon's work. Although he wasn't particularly strident in his politic, but I see that force working its way out in his writing in the same way contemporaneously it might have worked out in the writing of I.L. Peretz or someone else across the Jewish world.
Do you want to? I guess I won't say too much, but I like Alma's conception of Ninette as a subversive figure, because I think that's very much the case. She's not just representing Jewry, but the book itself and through the stories that Ninette recounts, what we get is a kind of interesting portrait of the diversity of Jewish experience in Tunisia at the time. You're right to point out, Alma, that there's almost no references to Muslims in the story, but within the potentially hermetic Jewish world that is depicted, there is interestingly quite a lot of internal violence. It's not an easy world of happy getting along, right? And so in a way, this book shifts narratives that would pit sort of quote-unquote Jews against Arabs by pitching a world that is homogeneous in certain ways but within which there resides a really incredible diversity of experience, class, politics, education, and even access to modernity. So one thing that comes out very strikingly in the other works by the Tunis School, where the authors speak a little bit more readily in their own voices as opposed to borrowing a protagonist's voice, we really see these three men who are educated in Paris, who've been trained at the AIU Institute, we see their vision of the Tunisian Jews as being almost passed through a kind of Orientalist filter, which is very interesting. This comes out really strongly in the appendix to this book where we've had translated some of the letters that Vitalis Danon wrote to the Home Office in Paris. and also a sort of travelogue that he wrote when he visited the island of Djerba. And you see that his vision of the Jews of Djerba very much uses a kind of language of modernity versus barbarism, right? Civilization versus savagery. And so in ways, Ninette actually does quite a lot of work as a character to get at all sorts of different corners of the Jewish experience that I think, as Sarah said really interestingly, can also be sort of extrapolated to the broader Jewish experience.
So maybe that leads into a question about Danon himself, and something else you reference in the introduction that I think is worth bringing out is he himself is from the Alliance system. He's someone who has thoroughly ingested the Alliance ideology. Right. I think it was his father. He was happy about his father being the first apprentice of the Alliance. So what does it mean for a quote-unquote Oriental Jew to Orientalize other Jews in this text?
Right.
Well, that also pertains to the question of poverty, because Danon, many Alliance teachers were chronically underpaid, or they weren't paid. Their salaries never arrived, or if they were married to another Alliance teacher, one would be laid off, and the other would be put in an untenable situation, and Danon was one of these. So it's not only about what Julia Cohen talks about as self-orientalizing, but it's also about poverty, that he is serving this elevated cause, but his service is driving him into penury. So that's another interesting aspect. So we maybe have you offer one more question and open it up for.
So I guess the question I'd like to conclude with before opening up is one about gender and the uniqueness of Ninette herself as the voice. We see it all through her perspective. Well, I mean, it's Danon writing through her, but it's quite unique to have her voice in particular and her interactions among other women. This sort of tense relationship she has between women of Sin Street, women of many different locations. So if you could comment on that uniqueness and whether, I know there's some question, I mean, is it feminist? Is it not feminist? What would that even mean to apply that to this work? So if you could comment a bit on, and one attached to that, I wonder what you think of Ninette always referring to herself in the third person, and is that dissociation?
Maybe. I don't know if I want to touch the feminist question. So there's a couple of things going on here. So there's the representation of gender relationships in the text itself. And much in an analogous way to the comment I made about this sort of homogeneous Jewish world on the outside in which there's quite a bit of diversity of experience and it's not all friendly all the time, within the homosocial female world of Sin Street, it's also not friendly all the time. These aren't all hookers with hearts of gold who are looking to take young Ninette under their wing. There is quite a lot of sort of, jostling for position, quite a lot of castigating of Ninette for some of the choices she's made, even if, as Ninette herself says, if only I could tell you about their life stories, the stories I could tell. So there's a bit of competition, right? It's a dog eat dog world. It's not out to paint a kind of proto-feminist portrait of female solidarity. The question of the protagonist's voice and the male author is an interesting one that I wrestle with a lot and haven't come to a kind of definitive read about. What I think is extremely interesting about this text is that you have a sustained female voice that is, I think, plausible and believable, that stretches over 100 pages, which is absolutely, I would go so far as to say, unheard of in Tunisian literature at the time that this was published in 1938. And we don't see the first female Tunisian authors, Jewish or otherwise, emerge until later in the 20th century. You might know of Shoshana Bukobza, for example, Colette Felouz. But at this point in time, there are no female writers working. So the idea that you have a sustained female, plausible female voice, to me, is an extremely interesting choice on the part of Danon. I think it does give a window into a sort of female psyche, if you will, that is, again, plausible. What's interesting, I hesitate to say this because I don't want to give away the end of the book, But our director, who has been basically the narratee, or the one to whom the story has been being told for the entirety of the novella, our director does intervene towards the end, and has interesting things to say about the enlightenment of Ninette and her son. And there's a reading, there's a way in which this end and this shift of the narrative voice and this shift of the voice of authority might change a feminist reading that one could have up until that point. I'm sorry if I'm sounding elliptical, but I really want you to read the book and enjoy it and not be disappointed that I've given away the end. But I think whether or not we read it as a feminist novella is almost a kind of anachronistic question. Certainly what's worth pointing out is the uniqueness of this approach and this character at this point in time.
Hmm. That's interesting. Well, I would add that beyond thinking about the moment of Ninette's literary formation, we can also use your question to think about what it means to publish a translation like this right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that the reason we were so motivated over a lot of frustrating years of not being able to obtain permission, legal rights to the translation, the reason we were so motivated was because it is so difficult to bring women's voices into the classroom. Mm-hmm. If one wants to teach Mediterranean Jewish materials. There are so few texts one can lean on. And so we thought that the translation could function as a text that would offer a feminist rereading of North African Jewish history and culture and letters. Mm-hmm. So I think your question in a way can be interpreted on two trajectories. Mm-hmm. And I think not only for the fact of it offering a female protagonist who suffers with all kinds of challenges that are a direct result of her being a young woman and before that a female adolescent and a girl, but also because it represents, as Leah has been describing, this fractured world, which runs counter to a more classical communitarian vision of Jewish history writ large, not only North African Jewish history. I think in those various ways, it can function in the classroom as a really radical text, and that was what drew us to it, its possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thank you for that. Mm-hmm. And maybe now we'll open up for your questions. Jared?
Answer this question like bits and pieces of it, but I'm still very curious. Mm-hmm. And the second question is about Edirne, in a sense that I'm guessing he was a native Ladino speaker, but French becomes his life, apparently. But do we ever get any sense of Edirne in his writing? Sorry, this is supposed to be an odd question.
I won't do the Ottoman question. So for the Tunis school, my understanding is that several other people sort of filtered in and out, but the three main figures are Vitalis Danon, who's the author of Ninette of Sin Street, a gentleman named Jacques Véel, and a man who went by the pseudonym Rivel. His real name was Raphael Lévy, so it's Rivel is R and then Lévy spelled backwards. It isn't at all clear that they called themselves the Tunis School. It seems that this was a moniker that was applied post facto by one of the few French scholars who's worked on this literature at all. The work, Sarah described it as ethnographic fiction, which is one way to describe it. It's highly folkloric. It's very interested in parable. All of the works are, the two other books that were published by the group as compendiums, so as multi-authored works, are Le Bestiaire du Ghetto, The Ghetto Bestiary, which is, both of these are earlier than Ninette de la Rue du Péché, and then another volume called La Hara Conte, or The Hara Recounts, and the Hara is the term that was used for the Jewish ghetto in Tunis. So we could also maybe call it The Voice of the Ghetto or something like that. So both of those two books, which are from late 20s, early 30s, contain true short stories by each of these three authors. And they are more Orientalist in tone and nature than Ninette is. They feature, for example, a character who is a teacher at the AIU who goes into the ghetto and who is horrified by the fact that 12 people sleep in the same bed and everybody has lice. There are a lot of kind of moralizing stories. And again, the parable is sort of the kind of genre or flavor I would give to much of their writing. They were published in Tunis and in Paris, so it seems to me that their audience would have been a French-speaking world, and obviously an elite French-speaking world in Tunisia, and potentially an audience in France that would have been interested in knowing more about the colonies. As far as we know in terms of our research, we haven't been able to find anything that suggests that there was any significant reception, no sort of book reviews in the press or anything like that. So we're not sure really how much these books circulated when they were initially published. Ninette, just to round this out, is an interesting departure from the other works of the Tunis School because it gets away so much from A, the figure of the school teacher being the primary voice, and B, the kind of folkloric moralizing tale that we found in the other works. I'll turn to you for Erdi.
Well, I'll briefly say that in framing this book, we did tell a little bit about the history of Edirne Danan's hometown and his own childhood and the conditions under which he and so many other Jews left in the course of the Balkan Wars and the First World War. But we didn't carry the thread much further. But I think that although we are framing Ninette in our introduction, and today we have as a product of Tunisian Jewish letters and Tunisian letters, in fact, to me, it actually also reads very much as a work of Ottoman literature and a document, a kind of primary source on Ottoman Jewry, because Danan, like so many other teachers of his generation who worked for the Alliance, wherever they were placed, shared an experience that was shaped by the particular interactions between the French Jewish bourgeoisie, the Ottoman world, the broader Middle East, and which sent these teachers, women as well as men, catapulting to places they little knew, but often experienced and interpreted and wrote about these places through the lens of their own Ottoman lives and lenses. So I think there is, in fact, a different way to tell the story of Ninette that foregrounds the Ottoman frame. Mm-hmm. But it's not really the project that we set forth here. But I think that it is really interesting. And it's also interesting that his hometown, Edirne, to imagine him moving, you know, here he is, this meant to be the man who brings civilization, and that, I mean, this goes back to your point about him being a so-called Oriental Jew, writing about other Oriental Jews, and that particular encounter is extremely interesting to me. A Jewish native of Edirne, trained in French educational mold, bringing French pedagogy to a Tunisian Jewish community. It's an incredibly complex layering of cultural, you know, moments.
Well, this is the question about another possible layer of that encounter. Sarah mentioned Paris, and I kept thinking of Shlomo Lekam when I heard Ninette speaking back to God. Mm-hmm. I wonder to what extent you can read this as a response to the sort of folkloric project of a lot of contemporary or slightly earlier Yiddish fiction.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the key word there is contemporary, that I don't think it's responsive because I think that it's happening precisely coterminously, and there is a previous generation of Ottoman Jewish writers, at least, who wrote this kind of folkloric work, but within the Ladino and French and sometimes Hebrew press, in exactly the same way that Shalom Aleichem and others of that cultural moment wrote. So I think it is. I think that it's less emulative and more coterminous. Mm-hmm. But that raises questions about perhaps what other bodies of writing they were participating in or responding to. Mm-hmm. And I suspect mm-hmm. certain French models, you right, know better yeah. than I, would have influenced both. Right. But rather than the influence moving from Eastern Europe to the Ottoman context or North Africa, my supposition, you can fill in, would be that there's a kind of a westward drift of an interest in folkloric materials, and in each context tinged with the particular fascinations and political pressures to produce truly local literature in, that was also globally informed. But mm-hmm. you may want to say something.
Yeah, I'm thinking, I mean, one of the people who reviewed and blurbed our book also pointed out the Sholem Aleichem sort of correspondence, or sort of felt like he was also hearing that as well. It would be so interesting to know what all Danon and the Tunis School teachers and writers were reading. And Danon does mention his reading in his letters, but from my memory, I only recall him mentioning French authors, Balzac, for example, but I don't recall any reference to other literatures other than the French classics of the 19th century. So, I mean, of course, this could all, various things could be seen as responding to each other without it being sort of intentional responding. But certainly we get a sense that the literary ancestry that he wanted to foreground was French.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the white coat.
Mm-hmm. And was not highly educated.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
If you don't mind, what is an orphan manuscript?
I mean, I think you're absolutely right, and this is one of the great interests of this text is the story, in a way, is timeless. Fortunately or unfortunately, the story of an unwed single mother growing up in a hardscrabble background. I mean, that. The nugget of the story needs no translation, in a way. As to the existence of Vitalis Danon as an actual person, we know it's his manuscript. We know that he wrote it. The fact that we weren't able to contact any living heirs doesn't mean he didn't exist. We know that this is the last of a very small corpus of works he produced. There is speculation that that the Ninette character is based on a young woman who came to see Vitalis Danon in his position as the director of the AIU school, and that in fact that he more or less transcribed what she said to him and then turned it into a novella. There's no supporting evidence for that, but it was one critic's speculation that Ninette was this real character who came to see him, and he just sort of took her story and made it his own, which would run counter to any feminist reading of the text, obviously. Someone else has also speculated that Ninette could have been the woman that Danon ultimately married, though again, we don't have any supporting evidence for that. And then you had one other question, the orphan manuscript. It means a manuscript that has sort of been cut loose of any potential family ties that would allow the family to come in and say, you know, you couldn't have published that without my permission, etc. Because of all of the good faith efforts Sarah and I made to contact people, it was deemed that that the orphan had no parents to be contended with. Thanks for your question.
Yeah, in the back.
Yes, that was a very interesting question about Sholem Aleichem, but I wanted to think about contemporaries of this writer, people who lived at the same time mm-hmm. and also, you know, published kind of similar work. Mm-hmm. As also including French writers.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, we know much better about the plight of Jews in Eastern Europe because Shakespeare, Singer, a lot about that. But the French writers, let's say, I read Numerovsky, who lived at the same time, and wrote at the same time, and of course, much later, Andrei Aciman, who wrote about Jews in Egypt. But I want to know what happened to those Jews in Tunisia after the book was published in the list, and the next was, say, 7 years, which were crucial. Did they survive? What happened to them during the Second World War? That's my question.
We do know that the three writers of the Tunis School survived the Second World War. As I'm sure this group knows, Tunisia was occupied, the Tunisian by Axis forces. The greater Jewish community of Tunisia was affected by anti-Jewish legislation. There were organized work details, there was a tax levied on the community, et cetera, et cetera. From what we understand, in fact, and Daniel doesn't speak much about it in his letters, but we know that at one point, and in fact, this is kind of an interesting anecdote for how light it is in the face of what would have been going on, that he had to move his family, I think, out of Tunis to somewhere in the countryside just to be out of the way, lest there be bombing, et cetera, et cetera. And at one point, he was supposed to go back to the family home to get some heirlooms. And what he did instead, because the family home was attached to the school, what he did instead was to save the furniture in the school. And so that's an anecdote that persists in his letters. But otherwise, in a way, the experience of having been occupied is not present in his correspondence. Nor in the other writings of the Tunis School writers, to my knowledge. But certainly they all survived. Danon died of natural causes in Nice in 1965.
Other questions? All right. Oh, yes, you have a question.
I found Ninette to be a very interesting character. In one sense, what made her different from all the other women that she found herself among? What was interesting about her? I mean, she admired the lawyers, but in a way, I sensed that she had learned from the lawyers and was applying that to her own plight. To me, I saw her as coming not from the gutter, but from a more affluent culture. But when it was her turn in life, this is where she finds herself. This is where she begins her life. And her life has almost tragic circumstances, and she's got a bastard child, and she has no paperwork. But she seems to struggle within the system to say, I'm not going to let that hold my child back. And I think there's even one part in the reading where the child does, the son is put on the path for a vocational school without the paperwork. So somehow she's overcome, you know, the obstacles in front of her. And what made her interesting to me was the fact that she had a perspective about the world that she lived in, but she could step back and comment on it. She wasn't just engulfed in it. She was aware of it. You know, she just didn't put one foot in front of the other and sleep and eat and everything like that. She could step back and relate her plight to other people and almost use it to her advantage, almost like entertaining them with her own tragedy.
Well, I would say, I mean, one of the other things that surely comes through in the readings that we selected for today is she's really funny. The character is really very funny and witty, and has this very actually not uncommon in Jewish literature, has a habit of misquoting from the rabbis, mm-hmm, and misquoting from scripture, but doing it in a very strategic, mm-hmm, way that serves her point. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think what makes her distinctive is the way that she, through her spirit and through her language, perhaps as you're describing, seizes control of the situation and barrels forward. And damn it, despite all the odds, her son gets a good education, mm-hmm, and he is on his path. Mm-hmm. And she too, at the end, as you know from our reading, has the promise of respectable employment. Mm-hmm. So she is a woman of self-invention. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes her compelling to the principal, mm-hmm, but also compelling to us.
Mm-hmm. Just by the very fact that she can comment, mm-hmm, upon her own circumstances, mm-hmm, means or suggests that she doesn't really belong there. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we'll let Ninette have the last word, because, mm-hmm, on that point she, mm-hmm, says, "Hope's cheap, say those who have everything they want. It's a fool's consolation, they also say. Fine, I'll be a fool then, but don't take away my hope." So, mm-hmm, thank you very much to Sarah and Leah for introducing us to Ninette, for your long labor of love, that we can all enjoy her sparkling humor and her story as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you all.